Welcome to TILF Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about drones. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at John Deere's new chief tractor officer. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of drones and spraying and spreading. Cool Beans, that's Corny. We'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Feel Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with TILF Agronomy. I feel like we say this every week, but it just never stops raining.
It doesn't stop. Ever. And this time brought wind. We haven't had wind yet. I mean, we've had wind.
We've had wind.
Not spray, but not wind that, you know, severe storm type of wind. So luckily nothing was that big to really wreck anything. And I didn't see, I saw a few wheat fields maybe flattened, but yeah, it just doesn't let up.
I had to pick some stuff up off the yard that just kind of went around.
Around, you know.
Lawn chairs and things like that. But otherwise, it did look ugly though.
Yeah. There was a tornado near Kashina that was part of that apparently. So
I do get nervous with storms like that that come mid after midnight when most people are sleeping. Like, do people, and maybe with phones now that everybody's maybe got their phone next to their bedside, that stuff goes off and you're good, but.
Yeah, because there's no sirens anymore, at least in Outagamie County.
No, so that's odd, too. Without the sirens is weird. You just are used to, oh, they'll go off. And, yeah, now it's all, you got to get a weather radio or have it kind of your phone subscribed to the correct thing. And, yeah, I don't know if the tornado sirens even went off many places. I know up north in Shawnee County.
Yeah, Bondwell area, I think they went off.
They're in north because they had the more, like you said, the confirmed tornado that was in Kashina area and just some high winds through a lot of Shawnee County.
And Underhill, too, I think it was hit by a part of that. From what I read in an article, anyway. I haven't driven through Underhill yet this week to see if...
We'll be up that way today, so...
There you go.
It was a wide band of yellow and orange and red.
And slow for severe weather. Like, it didn't... Normally, that kind of stuff blows through... But this was
it poured kind of for a long time. Yeah. Right. The heavy part was slower than you think. I mean, it was a fast storm, and the way it split was kind of odd, and kind of part of it swung south. And there, too, it seemed like hanging further south where they got more like 3 inches of rain in some spots. So, yeah, this is quite a – just doesn't stop.
Yeah, no, it's really sink or swim for these crops now at this point, like – they're either drowned out or in the process of being drowned out or, I mean, I don't know if, but you guys, and well, I think, Bill, you had a field like this, but I had one non-starter field. It got planted, but it was super saturated for the last, or since it was planted, and now I'm not very optimistic about what's going to be coming from that field at this point, so.
I had similar, Matt, where they were... A week ago when we had that Friday, it started raining midday Friday, kind of stopped, but then all day Saturday it rained. They kind of slammed it in before. The conditions weren't ideal when they put it in on Thursday or Friday last week, and I was there on Tuesday, and it's not even sprouted.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, well, with the rain we got on Saturday... And then that big storm we were just talking about on Monday night into Tuesday, when you're there on Tuesday and nothing's happening, not even it wasn't even cracking the seed coat or anything. And as warm as it's been, I've had corn that's up in 6 days.
Right.
So I think, yeah, the field's toast.
It's not even the amount of rain. I mean, that's been high at times. It's the days with rain.
Yeah.
So like Green Bay's airport, we've had 17 days of rain so far in June, and we're not even done with June yet. So we've had, you know, out of the 27
like 10 days we haven't.
Yes, that it hasn't rained. So that part of it's just wild to me of how much it's rain. Just rains all the time. And then, you know, when you look at the days it's not raining, the amount of wind on those days, you know, some, there's been a couple, but it's, you know, out of the other, say, 10 days, I think I counted about four of them where the wind would be too windy to spray. And it just, all of that stuff just compounds that. I just feel like you're chasing it all the time on springs like this. And I always hate that feeling. I always like to be fairly proactive, be ready for something, you know, have the foresight. But rain can just take that and change it very quickly, that you got to change plans and then change what you're going to spray, what you're going to plant, all kinds of things just start dominoing.
We're playing Mother Nature's game. She's not playing our game.
Yes.
She's in full control at this point.
We're the pawns. She just moves us around.
It's funny how, like, 2023 had its frustration, but humbling wasn't... It felt like yes, it was dry, but you could at least do it. Wet years always just are extremely humbling to me of, like, how little control you do have. You know, 2023, you go out and cut hay whenever you wanted. You could spray kind of whenever you wanted, and it just sort of worked out. And this year is like the opposite. Like, oh, yeah, you got plans to do this, get this done, or this kind of goal. Like, nope, this is what's happening.
The good part about 23 was, like you said, Todd, you could do anything. So, yep, it might not have worked. Like,
right.
We could have went out and sprayed. It may not have worked, but at least you had the opportunity to come back and hit it again or try again. This year, it's like, when you see a window, you better be ready to go, because that's the only one you're going to get. And if you don't hit it, you don't know when you're going to get that next window to fix something. And that's the frustrating part, like you said, Todd, where it's humbling. It's like, where do we go from here? There's so many fields right now that I don't have sprayed once because we just haven't had the chance. Couldn't. And yep, we're going to have to deal with some ugly fields for a while just because.
Yeah, I was talking to Derek. He was looking at research plots this week on some of the pre-emerge ratings for pre-emerge herbicides.
Yep.
And he said, you know, especially compared to last year, he said it was unbelievable how well the pre-emerges worked.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously we know that, but he had, you know, the numbers to back it up of, like, basically not just anything worked. It wasn't necessarily like that, but they just worked much better than last year. It, you know, to the point of, like, twice or three times better. So the
good news, actually got activated.
Yeah, right.
If you got it on, it worked, right?
Right.
And right.
I was talking to a grower yesterday. We were talking about last year how many, I think we had like a full page of respray for fields that he needed to go back and touch up. And I got the sheet here. There's four of them this year.
Yeah.
And it's like headlands and low spot. And he's like, well, I'm not going to get in that low spot anyway. I'm like, I realize, but I have to tell you about it. So anyhow, it's completely different. That part of it is comforting, that if you were able to get, like, your pre-on, or maybe you did an early post with some residual, like, that's working, and you can kind of just say, yep, we're done. If we're putting that field to bed, it's going to make it through. We don't have to go back and try to clean anything up because those work so well.
Yeah, last year we were, you know, quarter to half inch away from being okay. Like, we weren't going to maybe have the ideal season, but at least we would have gotten that activation. We would have gotten better germination. This year, it's like we're, I don't even know, 10 inches in the hole as far as, like, too much. And there, like you guys were saying, last year at least you could get out and do something. Now it's, you know, you just sit there and watch it and you think, okay, am I going to get a window? Especially after these last couple of rains, there's lakes and fields. Like, you drive from here to Shacton, and it is just pond after pond after pond and fields. So, I don't know. It's just...
Does the river in Shacton look like spring?
It looks like spring.
Looks like spring, yeah.
I mean, not way high spring, not where you're like, ooh, man, but high, not like late June. Ever. I don't think I've ever quite seen it that high in late June.
And the really kind of sucky part is if it does shut off now, this could be very bad for, like, just like what our corn ruts are looking like and everything else. And all of a sudden it dries up and
It doesn't look like it's going to.
No, it doesn't.
So, and every time you think it's going to, it seems to not. But yeah, Matt, you're right. Of when you start out on a wet year like that, you need it to stay. I mean, you can go through a few dry periods, but you need it to, in general, stay wetter because we've not set up these plants to withstand through a drought or anything like that.
So yeah, it'll be interesting. I think that kind of leads us into our topic: why 2024 might be the year of the drone. So, you know, we've had wet weather before. We've had really wet years. We've had a series of wet years in a row fairly recently, within the last 10 years. But like we talked about, it makes field applications difficult. I mean, we've had wind that kind of adds to that too, but biggest change since that last wet spell is the availability of drone application. And that's kind of the reason for the topic today is just I know I have, I think both of you have used drones for something at least this year. Whereas we can't say that I've had other years like that where we've,
I agree with you, Matt, of like we finally, the price, the technology, and then just the people out there having these has caught up. So in 2019, there was always talk of drones and everybody kind of.
And the airplane guys were kind of busy, right?
Right.
But there's not enough of them to go around.
Right. And it was like, oh, maybe we'll get a drone in for this. Well, I don't know that the technology was even quite there. And like we said, the people definitely weren't there that have them. And going back other wet years, 2014, 2004, basically you didn't have any. I mean, you could get a plane and maybe a helicopter, but that industry has been pretty similar for the last 20 years. I agree with you, Matt, that this year finally it feels like, at least as a farmer, most guys like kind of know a guy. You know, like you, it's like, oh, it's not like
there's always a guy.
Right. It's like, oh yeah, I got a guy for that and for everything. And now finally, like most farmers, I think, could say that they know of a drone guy somehow, maybe adjacent. Maybe they don't know him, but
they've at least been to a meeting where there's been that guy.
A guy there. And the other part is farmers also buying drones has become a thing. And that may take off too, just because of the scale of this is and how it's going to work. But yeah, I think that part of this could be, it already got me out of some wheat that needed fungicide.
Yep.
The drones are able to help with that quite a bit. And so now you're getting in a spot where maybe you need herbicide or something done, and they're able to maybe get us out of that bind too.
I mean, Bill, you mentioned that wet hole. That'd be probably a good
spot
for a drone application is if it needs to get sprayed, just keep the weeds down. They can fly right to it, and there's no wheel tracks or anything to have to worry about. But yeah, they're not the perfect solution for everything necessarily either, but they're constantly improving. And like you said, Todd, this year kind of been the right place, right time. The technology's there, and I think in the next few years it's just going to keep getting better. The one drone operator I talked to was really excited at the prospect of the swarm stuff getting approved by the FAA, where you can fly multiple drones at a time. So he's like, yeah, if I can get three of these going across the field, as they were doing probably about 25 acres to the hour, you jump that to 75 acres an hour, that's a pretty good improvement. I mean, obviously there's drawbacks to that too. You have to swap batteries on three drones. You have to fill three drones, whether it's seed or chemical. But yeah, I think right now there isn't necessarily a ceiling. The technology's kind of on the uptick as far as that goes. So
Zeb, what have you been hearing, Matt, for acres per hour realistic? I mean, obviously there's other fill time, charge time, all kinds of things that go into this, but what have you kind of been hearing the industry say that is kind of a norm that they're getting? Obviously different drones are going to be different too.
Yeah, it's been between 20 and 30 acres to the hour. So I haven't heard more than 30, and obviously you could get less, but for a number of reasons, whether it's having to pick up and move because of the small, you know, if you're doing a couple 5-acre fields, you're going to get less than 30 acres in an hour. But in general, if they can set up and keep going consistently, that seems to be kind of where things are at with a single drone. So, the ones I've seen, and the ones I've kind of brought up for the episode here are the DJI T40 and a Helio Egg 122. And I added the T50 because those are just coming out now. There's a few guys, I think, that are getting those, which is an improvement on the T40, but not as big of an improvement as I thought when I look at the specs.
It's 10 better.
But, yeah, 10 better. It's got to be 10 times better, right? What have you guys seen? Do you know what the operators you guys were?
The only one I've seen physically is that T40.
It was a T40.
Yeah, same.
And this Helio, I think it's a good one to talk about because it's quite interesting what kind of...
Yeah, this one actually, the one I saw operating was an older one because when I looked up, I was trying to find information on it. I had to go back to a picture I took of the drone to find the number that Egg 122. And now they've got some bigger ones and stuff too. But we'll start with the T40. So that one is a... DJI is probably one of the most common, I think, drones manufacturers that you see, whether you're a hobbyist or the ag stuff.
Photography.
Photography. I think...
Real estate, right? That market's...
I mean, we all fly DJIs, I think. I don't know that anyone in the company has anything other than that.
No, and we've looked at, 10 years ago when these were first coming out, there was a whole bunch of companies.
Yep.
And it seemed like Parrot, and I'm just thinking...
Yeah, I remember Parrot.
There's just a whole bunch. And it did seem to, as the industry sorted itself out and companies bought companies or companies just went away, this one, DJI, has been one that has been around a long time, was there from the beginning, and kind of would be somewhat the Google of drones, if you want to call it that, or the Apple kind of a... That way that, there's a lot of other good ones out there. We'll see how long this company does do well, but for now they've seemed to hold that. If you remember DJI at the first two, when you'd put a GoPro camera on them, and that was an interesting marriage of like they had the drone, you could get the camera from GoPro, and somewhere in their GoPro basically was like, nope, we're, basically saying, nope, this is still going to, this is how we're going to do it. And DJI is like, well, we can figure out cameras, and just basically took it off. And you'd think that would have hurt them, and it didn't in the camera part.
Now they're partnered with Hasselblad, I think, is most of the cameras.
Is the camera.
The drones now. Because that was a Phantom 2. The first one we had was a Phantom 2 with a GoPro mounted, so you could not watch.
It's still crazy to think that, Matt, that you couldn't see what you were doing.
Right.
You had to watch the drone and... just predict, like, okay, which way is it turned? Which way do I hit the joystick to make sure I don't push it the wrong way? Because now it's like a video game, right?
Now you can see you're flying in real time. Like, you can stop over something. Because with the Phantom 2, you had to buy the GoPro separate. And then there was a GPS software or a GPS dongle that you attach to it separate. And then that would, so you could like lay points and have it fly a pattern. Then you would get it back, and you would take the SD card out, and then hope that it captured what you wanted to. Otherwise, you had to swap batteries and try to fly it again and change your points and all that kind of stuff. Whereas now, you can see everything. You don't even have to take a video. You could just watch it in real time, fly down to something, fly back up. So the technology has come a long way. That way.
Even what's odd with that specific instance is GoPro tried to release the drone themselves in that battle, and in basically like 2 years it was discontinued. So just the whole drone battle has been quite a lot of companies pushed to the side that definitely lost. So, we're talking today about DJI and Helio are kind of two left. There's going to be many more that come, and we'll have to see what
many more that go.
Yes, right. What technology they come up with.
Yeah, it was interesting. The first years we were seeing all these drones at shows, there were ones that were basically like miniature airplanes by defense contractors, essentially like trying to get into the commercial space. And a lot of those have kind of gone away. But anyway, back to the T-40. So it's about 110 pounds with the battery in it. So it's not super lightweight, but it's not super heavy either.
That's just the drone, right?
No, that's payload. The drone itself without payload. So if you were unloading and unloading, or loading and unloading it from a trailer, back of the truck, whatever, it's with the battery, 110 pounds. And then its max weight is about double that. So when you're filling it with, whether it's spray, spray's a little bit less. That one, you're talking probably like 200 pounds versus 220 pounds with the spreading capabilities on there. So, yeah, it can basically carry twice its weight, or, you know, its weight again in whatever you want to fly it with. They're using GPS. You know, our newer drones that we've got have like anti-collision sensors. These have radar on them, so you can kind of set a perimeter to keep it away from whether it's power lines or obstacles. I know the one I was watching with the T-40, certain times hills would kind of become an issue in the field, you know, if the terrain was real big. And not like, they have to stop and start all over again. It was just they'd have to make some adjustments to fly it over that hill because it would think it was going to crash into it. And so, yeah, it's got GPS capabilities. Without a payload, it can stay in the air for like 18 minutes. With payload, it's closer to 7 minutes. So not really flying all that long. And that's, I think, the next evolution is just improving that battery time. We saw it with the smaller drones, too. First one, you know, we got maybe 15 minutes out of the Phantom 2. When one of us got a Phantom 4, I think it was up to like 20 or 25 minutes. Now the Mavics, I think, are like 30, 35. So
are you guys at all surprised that the technology hasn't gone to, instead of electric, gone to gasoline or some type of...
Well, it started there, actually.
Right, it did. You're right.
Autocopter?
I forgot about autocopter. What was that? That thing was like
5-gallon payload. And then I forgot about gas. But what do you think about it? Your payload drops so much because you have to have that fuel on board.
Correct.
And then, you know, the engine part of it is going to be way heavier than the little electric motors, right?
Right, but not than the... You just wonder, like, battery weight itself.
Yeah.
Because part of the problem is it's literally got to hold up itself. Right. So the like I said, I'm just surprised. I think we'll see that come. I'm going to make a prediction that I think we'll see one come back to the market, that you'll have the battery base, but you'll have some sort of drone that does use a different type of fuel, probably gasoline, is what I'm saying, to make it be able to stay out in the field longer, basically. I mean, yes, it's still got to hold up. And like you say, the engine itself is big, but, you know, we're not talking about having to put this huge engine on. It's like putting a weed whacker engine on.
I think you're right, but I think it's going to be more of a replacement for airplane crop duster.
Yes.
Like, I think it'll be you actually fly it when it's... Because in order to have the motor and everything else, I think it'll be smaller than an airplane, but so big that you'll still, like, flying it remotely will be kind of a challenge if you do get to that size. Correct.
That is a good point, too, Matt, is, like, you wonder where the scale changes here.
Right.
Because where the scale changes here, if you're going to have a small plane, then you just have a small plane.
Because I think the solution here is, like I mentioned before, the swarm idea, where you're flying multiple drones to get better coverage.
Right, you would not want to swarm that idea with, you know, if you're getting that type of copter, you wouldn't want to swarm them, right?
Right.
Right.
But yeah, we'll see where that goes. Then the T-50, has some improvements, but just a few pounds, really. It's a little bit heavier, and it can hold itself in kind of a similar payload. So I would have thought it would have been a huge jump in payload, but not really when you look at its base weight and then what it can carry. So I think there's some technological improvements on there. Unlike the T-40, because the T-50 is so new, I really haven't seen the flight time aspect. Maybe that's the big improvement, is the T-50s will be able to fly longer. Is that, I will say, and I don't know about you guys, but the T-40 I saw, and this was spreading seed, not spraying, could handle multiple batteries before its payload was expended. So it wasn't like it was empty. You know, the drone didn't have that timing down of where it could fly as long as it took to get empty. So it would come back, you'd swap battery, but you wouldn't necessarily have to fill every time you came back.
That is one of the challenges with, obviously you can't run the battery to zero or to even,
right.
You know, I think a lot of these are
20%.
Right.
Like that, yeah.
So there's this margin of
still gotta get home.
Safety there that they kind of build in that is one downside is, you know, you're never, it's not like you can, it's like when that the gas light comes on in your car, it'd be like having to stop and fill up immediately, not, well, I got 40 miles, I could make it. So that is one of the challenges, but, you know, you look at the battery life and say we've gotten better, but you still always got to build in that sort of 25% that never sort of gets used because you can't have it fall out of the sky.
Right. Yeah, and with the ones we use for like scouting and other stuff, if those land in the cornfield, it's more of a pain that we have to go find them because they're small. If this thing lands in a cornfield, it's going to take down some corn, and it's going to be a pain in the butt to like pick it up and carry it out.
And you potentially have a spill.
And a costly, yeah.
And a spill.
Yeah, right, potentially a spill, yeah.
I have like a heart attack when I'm flying a drone and it gets under like 10 minutes of fly time. Much less these drones where you don't even get 10 minutes. So as a drone applicator, you got to have some confidence that your 5 minutes application time is enough to that you won't do that fall right out of the sky. So that's a big difference from a normal hobbyist, I'll call it, drone.
Yeah. No, I mean, when you look at the legal side of drone certifications and all that, like you're not supposed to fly over people with the little ones. And yeah, maybe if you were high enough and it fell fast enough, it could hurt somebody. But 110-pound drone with another 100 pounds of payload falls on somebody, that's going to do so.
It's not good.
Right. So the risk-reward side of things, there's a lot of things to watch for with those bigger ones. Even hitting a car with one of those would be a pretty, right. Pretty damaging situation, whereas, yeah, my little Mavic hits a car, and it's like, oh, sorry, I scratched your paint. Here's $50, I'm sorry. Whereas, yeah, a 200-pound drone, that's like hitting a person or, you know, probably a scooter, smart car. Could do some damage. All right, now the other one I saw this year, and both the ones I witnessed in person this year were spreading seed. I have had farms use the spray drone. I just wasn't there to see that part of it.
I got a question for spreading seed.
Yeah.
Is it just a single, like basically a single spinner at the bottom, or do they even with the, I was wondering with the propeller wash, like if, but basically it just has a spinner, one spinner drops at the bottom and flings it basically.
Yes. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, whereas some of these for spray have like little booms. The T-40 and T-50 have atomizers. So they're using the propeller wash to kind of move. So they have little spinning discs that control the droplet size. And yeah, the propeller wash kind of helps apply it. So you're not covering huge areas when you're spraying with them. Or when you're spreading seed. But yeah, so now we'll go to the Helio Egg 122, which is the one I saw. Like I said, there's other ones now. I think they're up to like a 250. So as you would expect, the higher the number, the bigger the payload and everything else.
They're up to 270.
270, is that what it is?
272, yeah. 18-gallon payload.
And I got to love, even though the Helio, which is an interesting one because it's manufactured in Texas, there's still everything's like in kilograms and kph instead of the U.S. standard system of pounds. And so I got to do quick conversion here of the weight. So max takeoff weight for the 122 is 120 pounds. So it's a lighter unit. The actual drone itself is about 30 pounds and then can carry 70 pounds of seed. But even with the smaller payload, what was interesting about those is, so the T-40, T-50, it's a single battery. It looks like a little briefcase type thing. These, and this might change with the more modern ones, like the 272, you said, was the top end.
That, yes. Yeah. What's my favorite about it is they've got different size, you know, names. But so they've got the compact, which is the 210, 216 midsize, 230 heavy duty, and the 272 is Texas size.
Texas size.
So
I thought maybe it'd be like Ford's, like the King Ranch or whatever, the fancy version. So yeah, a little bit less holding capacity, but still pretty respectable there. Flight times again are probably pretty similar with the obviously the more payload the shorter your flight time gets. So if you start full, you're probably going to get the low end of the payload time on your battery. And then as it empties, if you don't have to fill it up every time, you're actually probably improving your time in the field until you fill up again and make it heavy. So yeah, it's very similar looking type of drone. It's a little squatter, more compact, I guess. Maybe that's why they call the one the compact.
Do you think you'd notice if that one, like, say from a distance, to me these would look the same, like similar enough, you know? Obviously, yep. They're just multi-rotor, you know, between six or eight rotors. Usually I think they're eight. And, yeah, bars going out and the tank in the middle. Like,
yeah, the design is slightly different, but, ultimately it's the same thing. Like the T-40 to the Helio was a top fill tank that you sort of weight sensors, and you could just lift the tank off to swap them out from spray to spread. Whereas with the Helio, you could fill from either side of the drone, so that was kind of like tucked underneath
the
top of the drone. So there's some design differences there, but ultimately, yeah, the average person driving by is going to be like, oh, I think that's a T-40. It's not like, driving past a Chevy or a Ford, you know, there's no big logos on the side or anything like
that. You'd have to be a drone nerd to figure that out.
Yes, and again, yeah, like I said, the average person, the drone nerd, they may have, could tell you every little thing about it.
You wonder where we will go. When these first started, they mainly looked like little helicopters.
Yep.
You know, and then you went to the quad copter, and like I said, now you're kind of the eight rotors. Like, are we going to go to 12 or 16, or how does that scale, and where does the change come? Like, right now, you basically put the payload in the middle, you know, and have just all kinds of rotors around it. It's just a really, really neat change, you know, change in how they look neat. I think they look really neat.
Yeah, no, like I said, I'm sure they're going to change little things, especially as they get from, you know, changing capacity size to how they spray. Like I mentioned, the atomizer, the Helio, from what I could see, is using more traditional spray nozzle type. At least on the older ones, the newer ones, maybe they've switched to an atomizer now, but, it's having to have, you know, hosing and, you know, different ways for these things to travel through the drone. That's going to change a lot of how it looks too. I've seen them with the little booms across the bottom. at conferences and stuff. So
that was unique. And shout out to the UW doing research on this. But in general, they said the boom, they're looking at, you know, is boom better or having the nozzles under the rotors? And just, I think the research still is ongoing. And this is Brian Luck's research there. But it found that, you know, some of these can be okay, even though they don't have necessarily the boom that we're used to. So just having that, you know, wash from the propellers changes stuff versus a traditional sprayer.
Yep. So when you get down to it, you know, why do a drone versus an airplane? Because the drone's got smaller capacity. You're looking at more concentrated, you know, we always talk about when you go from the ground rig to a plane, it's a different concentration of chemical to water, your different ratio of chemical to water, because the plane can't hold the same amount of water that a ground rig can. And then you get the same thing again with the drone. It's smaller. So your mix is going to be quite a bit different.
Would you say what I've seen, it's even less than a plane from what I can tell?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So, like, you know, a plane will run 2 to 3 gallons water with the product, and it seems as though the drone is less carrier. It's hard to tell what they're exactly using, but it's... So that is a difference there. One thing I would say is enough of these... Chemistries now are figuring out how to go with less water, you know, what the right rates are exactly for that. But I always get the questions on herbicides with these, and that might be one of the challenges, is just the water carrier rate for some herbicides may not work well with a drone.
And one thing I was going to mention with that is in the one herbicide, so the farm did a side-by-side with their ground rig against a drone, and it still got a kill, but the drone kill was much slower.
Okay.
So it didn't look as dead right away. You know how...
Same, what was it, Roundup, or what were they using? Do you remember?
I don't remember offhand what the exact chemical combo was in that case. But yeah, the farm at first was like, well, what the heck? Why did I waste the money on the drone? Like, I went out and sprayed and all the stuff I sprayed is dead.
Yep.
And this doesn't look like it's dying. And it just took longer. It eventually did die. But that could be something that would really cause some excitement if it's like, well, I just paid $20 an acre or so to do what now? And then, you know, planes, I think the biggest thing with planes versus the drones is a lot of times planes have minimum acres. You have to have X number of acres to do it. I haven't heard of any drone operators saying, oh, unless you get 100 acres, I'm not coming out. Like, they will come and spot spray. They will do all these other things that are more difficult with planes and ground rigs.
I had one doing some micros yesterday on some corn, and it was like 20 acres.
Yeah.
You know, and he wasn't, when he got there, because I just happened to be at the farm and the guy pulled in, and he wasn't in any hurry. Like, got 1,000 acres to do today. I better get this in. I mean, we BS'd for 20 minutes, and then the farmer and him went out on the road next to the field, and they, because I scouted some more, watching them kind of quarter of my eye, and they were BSing for a little more time. You know, it's like he wasn't in a hurry that, and maybe it was just yesterday, like the busy season is like not, is over, like the wheat, you know, there's a big busy season on wheat, so he's busy. Maybe it's a little lull right now, so he wasn't super in a hurry, but...
Well, I think that they can operate in a lot more weather conditions. It can rain 20 minutes before they go out there for spreading
ground
wise.
Conditions, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not worried about driving. The winds is just is important.
Wind is important, but even that, you know, those drones handle some wind pretty well. I mean, if you're spraying chemical or spreading, for that matter, wind is definitely a consideration for everything. I mean, planes... too, if you were trying to fly it on. And
well, conventionally, Matt, like the plane people were connected more with the co-op system.
Right. Still are.
Yeah, and so it's harder for a farmer to, like, I had one a couple weeks ago when I called the plane company themselves, and I have not received a phone call back yet.
Like, no, like you say, they've got, because the scale is different, right. It just seems like that's good. And then the co-op was bringing them chemical and kind of filling them, you know, hot loading them in a way. So I think that just paired out where these scale down a lot better to be in a...
Yeah, there's no runway that you have to have.
Right.
load a tender truck at to...
No.
I mean, that from what I've seen, the guys that are spraying with these drones, they've got trailers for with generators to charge batteries and all this other stuff, and tender tanks.
There is a tank in the back of the trailer. Right. Yeah. What I would say that part of this is the drone itself is actually probably the, I don't want to say the easiest part of the system, but it's the accessories that sort of get you. Because even the drone isn't all that expensive. It's the additional batteries, the type of generator you'll need, you know, the tendering system to make it worthwhile. So I think that part of this too, if you're looking to get in it, well, the drone's not that expensive. No, it's the other stuff. And that's what gets sort of tricky on it, maybe. Or you make sure you obviously, and that's going to be in the total price, so you know it. But it's not like buying a new car where, you know, maybe it is like a little buying a new car because all of a sudden you got all the other, you know, add-ons and fees and all the stuff.
Drone is once it's off the lot.
You know what? I think that part of this, it's not once it's off the lot. It's every year the technology is going to get so much better.
Right.
That, you know, we saw that with our first drones that within, you know, months they were debunked. And these aren't going to be like that, but you know, the technology.
Yeah, they're usable, but there'll be something better.
Right. Something way better with better battery life. That part of it too, it's the batteries and how long they last and good they are. So.
And here with the other thing before we wrap up with the drone that I wanted to mention is, you're generally a lot closer to the crop and consistently closer. So I would imagine.
Comparatively to a plane or a grounder?
Right. Because your plane, you're coming down.
Yeah. Okay. I thought.
And then coming up.
Yeah. Would you say you're about the same distance as a ground rig or not? Or a little higher off?
It's probably a little higher.
That's what I would say. Yeah.
So.
But I would say with the plane, you're using speed of the plane to just sort of ram it down into that
inertia
canopy.
Carrying,
yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Whereas the drone, you're using, you know, both the rotor wash and you're closer.
And the accuracy is better, right? Because a plane, let's face it, you're getting the road ditch, right?
You're probably getting off-field
travel. There is off-field
travel,
right? So with the drone.
In general, those guys are pretty good.
Yeah, there is still some. But I think with a drone, you can get in nooks and crannies a little bit better.
Yeah.
You're closer.
And maybe not so much the off-field, but you're getting all the field too.
I think you're comparing to the wrong thing. You should compare it to a helicopter sprayer.
Right.
Those helicopter guys, they would do. Remember, we had a helicopter guy do roundup for us that one time. What year? That was 14.
But how many helicopter sprayers do you?
Correct.
See?
They're not as but I'm just saying that's similar technology, just scaled down.
So if you're out there and you see drones or you're using drones yourself, you're not alone. There's been a lot of it this year, especially. And I think moving forward, if guys like the results they see, it'll continue. I know I've got a farm that's talking about doing all their corn fungicide with a drone versus trying to get the plane for a number of reasons, high lines and everything else that could potentially cause issues. So, 2024 may turn out to be the year of the drone, and it could just be the beginning. So we'll see where that goes. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. A little while back, we talked about John Deere searching for their chief tractor officer. And they worked with Brock Purdy of the San Francisco 49ers to launch the search back in April for this person. And they have now just announced the chief tractor officer. And it is a recent college graduate named Rex Curtis. And the irony is they announced a bunch of layoffs right before they announced this position, but we won't talk about that part of it.
That's corporate.
That's
corporate.
That's corporate
there.
John Deere says, as the new face of John Deere social media, including its brand new TikTok channel, Rex will bring awareness to people and industries who work tirelessly to support us every day. Curtis was hired due to his standing as a budding content creator on TikTok. And is a recent graduate in environmental studies. Deere says his knowledge and passion for the industry aligns well with the mission of the chief tractor officer. You can follow at John Deere on TikTok and Instagram to catch Rex as he heads to Indiana for his official training with tractor enthusiast and TikTok sensation Jackson Lau, according to John Deere. So There you go. It's happened. The CTO is in the house. We'll see what kind of content he creates and if it goes viral. All right. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So since we're talking about drones for spraying and spreading, I thought talking about the history of spray drones would make sense for this episode. So the start is not necessarily new. The first spray drones were used in Japan in 1997. So Todd, you and I were still in middle school when spray drones had their beginning. But it's taken this long, at least in the U.S., for it to really gain popularity. And so the first one was a Yamaha R-Max drone, which looked like a small helicopter. It had a single rotor with a diameter of about 10 feet, weighed 207 pounds, and had a 4-gallon spray tank capacity. It's a full tank and spraying at 1 gallon per minute. It would empty its tank in about 4 minutes. It was gasoline-powered, could run for an hour before refueling, and could be retrofitted with 3 or 4 nozzles, and was FAA-approved for use in California by 2015. This aircraft had a terrain sensor and could be operated manually or on autopilot. The manufacturer did not sell the aircraft, rather they serviced it and provided a trained team of 2 to 3 people to operate the aircraft. As aircraft got lighter, easier to operate drones for spraying pesticides has been happening over the last few years. They're lightweight but powerful enough to lift a 10 to 15 gallon tank now. Most commercial spray drones today are multi-rotor. The drone's propellers create turbulence in the canopy, which significantly improves droplet penetration into the lower parts of the canopy compared to traditional ground sprayers that are not air-assisted. Multi-rotor drones also have similar components, can be different in many ways based on number of rotors, rotor positions, and that's, I think, a difference between the two drones we talked about earlier is where the rotors are positioned on the aircraft and how many. Nozzles and locations and configurations, types and number of nozzles, distance between nozzles, and vertical distance between rotors and the nozzles underneath them. So we're going to continue to see lots of expansion. Like I said, traditional nozzles to these atomizers that some of these drones have. There is a pretty high potential, but it's not entirely surprising because I remember talking about it a lot early on with the drone stuff, but it is kind of crazy to think that it's almost 30 years of spray drones. But
that is crazy, man.
A lot more popular in Asia to begin with. So
yeah, it's crazy how far, I don't want to say behind we are, but behind, you know, slower in adoption to the technology. But like you said, maybe this is the year of the drone that it comes here. So thank you, Matt, and thank you to all our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's real easy. Just search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts or on your Android phone. Download an app like Podcast Addict, and there you can hit the subscribe button. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now it's time for some cool beans. That's corny. So cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans. So this week we've got a two-headed animal here. It's both a cool beans and that's corny.
These are my favorite.
And that is because there's currently legislation in the works to ban DJI drones in the U.S. So we just talked about how we run DJI. There's spray drones out there, real estate, photography, all these different places that hobbyists that use these particular drones. And biggest thing is because they're made in China. So DJI stands for Dajiang Innovations.
But is it technically because they're made in China or just because of the other parts that come along with downloading their app and, you know, where the data is going?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things made in China.
A lot of it's built into
that we're not
the
banning.
Right,
it's the other. It's it's the same thing with like TikTok and what that.
Yeah, they're concerned. So the basis is they're concerned that China is collecting information through them. So, like you said, it'll affect a lot of different people, but it is not retroactive. So it will only ban future drones. It will not, all the ones that are currently on the market or owned by folks in the U.S. will be fine. There won't be changing anything with that. It's anything new. So as technology changes, basically they're saying they won't update it and allow it to connect to infrastructure in particular, but anything maintained by the Federal Communications Commission or the FCC. So the idea is that, again, they're worried about information collecting through the different softwares, apps, and different things that are tied to these particular drones. So data security being a big thing, you know, in general, I think cyber crimes and all the other types of data collections between Russia and China have been a big topic over the last few years. And so DJI itself is hoping to avoid the ban. It's not a for sure thing at this point. It's passed the House. It's got to go through the Senate and then obviously be signed by the president to become law. But yeah, there is this potential. So, I mean, it's a cool beans because obviously we don't want anyone stealing our data and using it in a way that will hurt people or the egg industry in general, any industry. But at the same time, it's a huge section of the market because their technology has been one of the better ones, obviously by the sheer number of them that are out there on the market and being used. So, yeah, it's just kind of it's a tough one to say that, yeah, I fully support it or, gosh, I hate it. But, you know, obviously, if there is an issue, we want it fixed, and I'm sure they'll find a way to either come up with a solution, or if not, then another company will hopefully move into position to take over.
Do you wonder what the solution will be of where they house their servers with the data, or where? How, I don't know.
Right.
You just, how this goes will be very interesting, and I would agree with you, Matt, is that anytime. We don't want to stifle in innovation either, so that's a tough thing too. Of you know, we've hopefully like this Helio, and there's other ones that come to market that'll work. But if it's just replaced by another Chinese drone company too, that doesn't really So I'm sure this ban can't just single one out. Maybe it's more of the sector or something. But and hopefully it singles out how that is being used, that data is being used, so that no, you know, whether it's, I don't care where it's located, I don't want them using our data against us. So
yeah. I hope they really enjoy all my pictures of corn.
Yes.
Right. And find it very fascinating.
Go for it.
Not sure what you can learn from it, but yeah, I think there are other sectors that use those drones that there is potential for that data to be used.
Right.
I'm thinking engineering firms and all the other stuff that I'm sure they're using a lot of drones.
Well, construction sites,
yeah.
A lot of things, like you say, Matt.
But yeah, as far as the egg side, though, I struggle to think of anything that we're taking pictures of or using the drones for. Like, ooh, their stand counts are looking a little rough over there. We should maybe that'll affect markets. I don't know, but yeah, so that's out there. You might hear more about it. If you have your own drone and it is a DJI, then, like I said, the plan is not to make it retroactive where they basically flip a switch somewhere and your drone won't work anymore. It's going to be any new technologies, but also replacement parts could become more expensive because there'll obviously probably be some sort of tariff or something else attached to anything that does make it to market. So could see an increase in drone prices because of this. All right. And then we'll wrap things up with our Feel Good Friday. So if you are familiar with June, not only is it dairy month, but it's also strawberry month. It tends to be the time when strawberries become ripe and people start picking them. And we have a local farm that has dairy cows and strawberries. And they've helped keep six generations of the Cluth family on their farm. So in the Clintonville area, Glendale Farms is in northeastern Waupaca, and it's unique because it has a modern 300-cow dairy, but also features 30 acres of strawberries along with raspberries, several varieties of peas, and other vine-ripened produce that customers can either pick for themselves or purchase freshly picked. This diversified farming enterprise has kept the family working together across six generations. Like many family operations, Glendale Farms grew from humble beginnings. In 1893, E.W. Zell and his wife, Catherine, purchased a small dairy farm after emigrating from Germany. Their daughter, Myrtle, and her husband, Paul Cluth, became the next owners of the dairy herd, while also raising hogs and laying hens. Paul and Myrtle's son, Glenn, and his wife, Beatrice, became the third generation. Then Dale and his wife, June, the fourth. And now currently Dale and June were the ones that made the expansion in 1978 to grow strawberries. Begin with an 8-acre patch that has expanded to 30 acres. 2004, Dale and June retired, yet still continue to live nearby. The family farm was then taken over by Steve and Tammy, marking the fifth generation to take over the farm. And the sixth generation is working there as well. The couple has three adult sons, Cody, Connor, and Colton. They like their C's. Who began participating in the business when they were young by raising and selling onions. Cody and Connor are sixth generation actively involved with the farm, while the youngest son, Colton, is a forester who works, whose work involves traveling around the country. So it's kind of cool to see that tradition carried on, and I think we've seen a lot of farms try to diversify in different ways over the years, but
they've got delicious strawberries.
Yeah, yeah.
They are also like, strawberries. Yep. Yeah, my wife and, you know, she'll take every, yeah, when she goes, like, my mother-in-law go with her. I know our mother goes there, Bill, like, they're good strawberries. They're easy to pick.
So get over there.
Yeah. I'm sure out there the season's kind of coming to the end just with the wet season can maybe kind of mess something up. But, yeah, it's a good place to go pick strawberries. I know, I think my wife was out there 2 weeks ago. She went one day, and on the way home, one of our boys got carsick and he was throwing up. And then the other one's like, he's puking blood. Yeah. It was just all the strawberries that he had eaten. So
sure, he was carsick. Yeah. Well, wasn't the 2 pounds of strawberries right, he ate while he was picking.
Right. That's always the joke. They should weigh you in and weigh you coming out. But I've actually never been there, driven by it a bunch of times. Have you guys ever picked out there?
No. Nope.
Yep, I've been to that one, been to Porter. You know, there's
there's patches. Porter's. There's there's one out in Howard. Yeah, there's a good amount of them, which is good.
Yep. So, yeah, and they do have other produce throughout the season. So, you know, even if strawberries are starting to wrap up here, you've still got the opportunity for green beans, peas, and other things there. So it's cool to see a local farm finding their niche and doing well. So that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about drones and different types of applications they can do and technology that's continuing to grow. In our spotlight, we looked at John Deere revealing their chief tractor officer. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of the spray drone. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we talked about the DJI drone ban here, potentially coming here in the U.S. And our Field Good Friday was Glendale Farms and their six generations of history here in Wisconsin. Thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.